welcome to Bombshell. I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I'm Erin Simpson.
And we are here this week for an awesome discussion of all things White House mayhem, keeping up foreign relations, and pop culture. But before we get started, we have a very exciting announcement.
The talented Erin Simpson has joined a new employer, a leading global aerospace company, which I think, Erin, is a good time for a reminder.
We do not speak for our employers. We speak only for our lovely and brilliant selves. And
luckily, the booze helps with that.
Right, exactly. We speak for no employers. This week, however, we are speaking for Pimm's Cups in honor of Queen Elizabeth's birthday. Pimm's Cups, as you, if you have not had one before, are a delightfully refreshing summer beverage that I highly recommend. And some cookies courtesy of some leftover CNAS event earlier today.
What would be the Queen's birthday without some savory snacks?
I mean, they're tiny cakes.
Sweet snacks, in fact.
I feel like it's very fancy.
Tiny pink little cakes. This week we have a wonderful guest, Mara Carlin, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy. Currently just recently started a new job at Johns Hopkins SAIS School. She'll be joining us this week to talk about all things Middle East and many other issues. And for now, I will talk awkwardly for a second because that was a great transition. So, like I said, we're here this week with Mara Carlin, the former fabulous Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and many other fun and exciting things. As usual, we're going to run through our bombshell guest questions, the first of which, Mara, is what is the best meal you have ever eaten while traveling?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here. So the best meal I ever had, I'd actually say, is the most memorable. And it's because it's a meal I didn't really have. I was a young grad student in the UAE, and we were having lunch with these sheikhs in the desert, sitting on the floor, eating with our hands. But I was a vegetarian at the time, so I didn't really have this amazing meal that they made for us. And I came home and decided to stop being a vegetarian.
Good decision.
Wow.
Indeed.
Probably something that could have happened a little bit earlier, so you could have eaten the meal, but...
No doubt. Lack of strategic planning there. I was not a defense strategist at that stage.
What is the book that you have either reread the most or owned the longest?
Probably Thinking in Time by Mayen Newstat. It's this fantastic read about how we use analogies. Effectively, their argument is humans are always using analogies. We can only take in so much information at once. And so you want to make sure that you're smart about it. So when a new event comes up, don't say, oh, it's just like that one thing I happen to know about. And actually ask kind of rigorous, what they refer to as journalist-like questions.
So Mara actually inspired me to read this book, which I've now read 2 or 3 times. And it excites me so much every time somebody makes an analogy that I can tell them, that's wrong. Why did you make that analogy? So thank you, Mara, for giving me the ability to
tell people they're wrong.
Another dimension along which. Okay, next question is, what is the fan club or fan community you have been a part of in your life at some point?
The fan club or fan community is probably just being a part of the SAIS world. I did my
that's
master's
not a fan
and PhD.
Club. That's just a creepy. Cult.
That's just a creepy cult.
It's a mafia. But it's probably the best one. Or people from Wisconsin who live in D.C.
That's right. You guys get together for cheese.
And cow tipping.
That sounds right. A lot of cows here.
Okay, well, Mara, you recently came out of government, so you probably have been on social media slightly less. But I have to ask, who is your Twitter or Facebook faraway crush, if you have one?
So I'm a total Luddite, and I'm on neither Facebook nor Twitter.
That's what I figured.
But I've started looking at Twitter,
Not to indulge the host.
It is clearly a gateway drug, and I don't know how to actually get work done and read it.
There's not a way possible.
Give up now. There's no hope. Thank goodness this wasn't around when I had to do a PhD. But probably you, Lauren. That was my Twitter crush, too.
Thank you, guys.
She's just so good.
I know.
And we know she is in person, too, but my God.
And Twitter, it's just like this unfiltered, like, I'm just going to say whatever I like.
It's just a funny version of things I think in my head.
Nice. You think all kinds of funny things in your head, Radha.
That's fair.
Different kind of funny.
Okay, less flattering, I assume, is what is your favorite museum?
My favorite museum is the National Museum in Beirut. Oh. So what's neat about this museum is actually not what's inside. It's like regular Roman sculptures. But it's located on the Green Line, which is the line that divided East and West Beirut during the Civil War. And so they wanted to save all the kind of priceless sculptures during the war. And so they preserved them all in plaster. So there's this amazing exhibit there where they talk about doing tours where you would walk around and you'd stand in front of just a big plaster box and they describe like the amazing historic Roman sculpture underneath it.
Wow.
It's like some sort of metaphor. Like you can't actually see it. You have to... Interesting.
Oh. Schrodinger's sculpture. Okay. Related question. What is your best geek field trip that you have ever been on?
So I'm not going to say a SICE staff ride.
Shocking.
Because that's what everyone else does, even though it's true. But the other one I would say is actually when I was a graduate student at SICE, we went down to participate in Robin Sage. So this is part of the qualifying course, and we played kind of various insurgents. And it was this really neat opportunity for sort of students who are studying and reading and learning to actually watch people go through some incredibly challenging training.
Highly recommend people, if you ever get a chance to move to a town around where they do Robin Sage, definitely send us a postcard. I really want to know about it.
It was like camp for adults.
Okay, last question, and I can't believe I have to be the one to ask this. What is your favorite statistical distribution?
So as someone who likes qualitative research, this breaks my heart a little bit. So I'm going to throw out the Alexander George structured focused case comparison.
And then not a distribution.
Not a distribution. And so I will back that up and then say it has to be just a normal standard distribution. But case studies are so much better.
They are, I agree.
Oh.
They're an important compliment.
We're going to allow you to continue on the rest of the episode, but understand that's with some reservations.
No doubt.
So the reason that we asked Mara to come on today is for a number of reasons. Namely, when I first met her many years ago as baby special assistants back in OSD policy, she was the only one in the office who actually pronounced any of the Middle Eastern countries or words or names somewhat correctly. So she seemed to have an idea of what was going on. That was my indicator. That, and also she's really brilliant and awesome and fabulous in many other ways. So there's a lot going on in the Middle East right now. And I think Aaron has the first key question, which is,
how do you pronounce Qatar?
We should totally start with the basics. I love that question. So there's actually no agreed upon way to pronounce it.
Even in Arabic.
So not really. You can't go wrong. So there's Qatar, there's Qatar, there's Qatar. On the whole, they're fine. You can choose as you wish.
Choose our own adventure.
Choose our own adventure.
That mimics so much else of our Middle East policy at the moment.
Doesn't
that it's very satisfying.
We can just get our names right. We're just halfway there to a strategy.
So if you could, you know, we recorded our last episode just the day before this kind of crisis broke out. I had read a little bit about some of the things that were percolating, some hacking, some stories that were in the media, and then all hell broke loose, right? So we have essentially kind of an embargo or certainly border closures between Qatar and Saudi and the rest of the kind of Gulf Sunni allies of Saudi. Can you give us just kind of a background? How did we get to here? What's the deal with Qatar? Mm-hmm. And is this a huge crisis? Is this something that we've seen before? Or where are we at?
Mm-hmm. So this is definitely not good, but we've seen dissonance amongst the Gulf states from time immemorial. I mean, effectively, they agree on what they don't like, but they don't agree on what they do like. The Gulf Cooperation Council was set up in 1981 out of fear of Iran, not because they loved working with one another. Mm-hmm. So we saw this a few years ago in 2014 when they withdrew their ambassadors. There was a brouhaha, hullabaloo. They came back together. So we're seeing something like that, but a little bit worse. And
Qatar's kind of a problem child. Is that correct?
So folks will get upset with Qatar because they'll say, look, you support various Islamists. You host Al Jazeera. You will talk to the Iranians more than we will. At the end of the day, those are all accurate. But in particular, a lot of the Gulf states just don't like Qatar's independence.
Hmm. Independence from whom?
So traditionally, Saudi Arabia has really been the power that has set Gulf policy. Mm-hmm. And for better or worse, many of the other Gulf states have kind of gotten in line with that.
I see.
And so you've seen Qatar, particularly since about 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. I mean, a country the size of Connecticut, where like 90% of the population isn't even from there. And suddenly they're in the news a lot. They're brokering various deals and agreements. And they're sort of on the stage in a way that's discomfiting to the Saudis.
And for our listeners, just remind us, who are the other Gulf states that are getting upset about this?
So in particular, you see Bahrain and the Emirates that are getting upset. The Saudis, obviously. And then the Egyptians have also played a role here.
In particular, over Muslim Brotherhood concerns, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. Qataris have relatively longstanding support.
Absolutely. And they've harbored a kind of Hamas types.
Right.
So all very valid reasons, but it's a lot more complicated. I mean, some of this is really just power politics. You know, there's been this talk of this Arab NATO that I know mm-hmm. the administration's trying to pull together. And I remember back in 10, 11 years ago, we tried to do something similar, a Gulf Security Dialogue. The challenge is, on the whole, these countries will work with the United States, but they're not terribly excited about working with one another in a really meaningful way.
So what does it mean then that we saw Secretary Tillerson trying to start some initial mediation efforts, which were, frankly, it seemed pretty much undermined by the president's comments, or at least his tweets, with regard to kind of blasting Qatar. Do we usually choose sides in these spats, or have we really put ourselves into a corner at this point?
This is a pretty clear choosing of sides. And when I look back, it's kind of hard.
We've chosen the Saudi side, obviously.
Appears we've chosen that side. And that's a little bit dangerous, because when you look across the region, I think people really love to boil it down to it's a Sunni-Shia fight. Yes, and it's a Persian-Arab fight, and it's a nationalist fight, and it's a Gulf-Levant fight, and it's a tribal fight, and it's a personalities fight and power politics. So there are, I like to joke, there's about, 19 different layers, and even those of us who've studied the region for decades maybe only understand 7 or 8 of them.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that certainly a lot of folks have keyed onto, and Secretary Tillerson obviously highlighted this, is that we have a very large air base in Qatar. We have a combined air operations center there as well. Does that further complicate this, or are there implications for the counter-ISIL fight and the airstrikes being rung out of there? Or is this basically going to work itself out at the diplomatic level, do we think?
It should work it out diplomatically, but the fact that the U.S. appears to have chosen sides could potentially undermine that. This is the largest base in the Middle East. As you noted, Aaron, so much in the counter-ISIL fight is coming in and out of there. You've got coalition members at the Combined Air Operations Center. So any tweaks to that would be problematic. It's worth noting, we used to have a lot of this back in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and that ended up being kind of problematic. So we moved it to Qatar. The Qataris have been really supportive of the base, not least because it lets them kind of strike this delicate balance or this dance where they get to kind of play all sides.
Right.
And so if you were to see some sort of effect on our operations against ISIL, this would be really, really unhelpful.
So speaking of ISIL, kind of last question is, there's been a lot going on in Syria this week. We're going to get to that later in the episode. What are you watching with regard to U.S. actions in Syria, Iranian actions in Syria, Iraq, back and forth, mm-hmm. kind of what's piquing your interest or keeping you, if not awake at night, at least mm-hmm. keeping your eyes open for?
So I'm most worried about the potential for a serious conflagration between the U.S. military and Hezbollah and the other Iranian militias. This could get really dangerous, and I'd like to think that there's some sort of contingency plans figured out. But the Iranians are all in Syria. Hezbollah, even though it's not necessarily in its interest, is all in. And it's, on the whole, just a real problem for, totally inarticulate, starting a new sentence. We could see some sort of conflagration between the U.S. and Hezbollah or these militias, and that's really dangerous. The operating space in Syria is only so big.
And getting smaller, it seems.
And it seems, these groups like Hezbollah have been responsible for the deaths of American servicemen and women in Iraq over the last decade and a half. We know that. That doesn't mean we should run right into conflict with them.
Mara, I have one last question to kind of tie this all together. So it seems like the U.S. policy has been really occupied by these crisis-to-crisis-driven responsiveness or reactiveness to what's going on in the Middle East, and as a result are possibly missing what are some bigger picture risks or threats that we're not seeing right now, or what are some of the risks of some of these smaller threats escalating into much, much larger conflicts of some kind? And I'm curious, from someone who's been studying the region for so long, what are we not watching right now that we really should be paying attention to?
That's a really fantastic question. A couple of thoughts on it. So the 2011 uprisings, which you recall so many folks were really excited about, those might turn out okay in, say, 3 decades, but no time soon. And so all of these kind of power brokers that the U.S. government would work with or the U.S. military would work with, they don't have the power that they used to have. Mm-hmm. And so I worry that we're used to just kind of talking to the same folks about the same thing and not realizing they're profoundly worried about domestic issues, right? There's a reason that you have various states cutting off relationships with Qatar, not least because of Al Jazeera, right? A kind of a news station of sorts. They're really worried about their domestic picture. And so they don't have the ability to wield power the way they used to. They can't broker the deals the way they used to, and we need to be cognizant of that. I also worry that we're still a little bit stuck in kind of the borders of the Middle East. And look, they lasted for a long time. That's terrific. I think they've become pretty fungible at this stage, particularly around the Levant. Mm-hmm. That's a very uncomfortable kind of dynamic to acknowledge, but yeah, it seems pretty true. And then finally, it's not clear to me, do we have just a counter-ISIL strategy? Do we have a counter-Assad regime strategy? These could lead to very different outcomes, and it's not really clear what our goal is.
As I have tweeted 3 times now, I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him, what is your serious strategy? Mara, thank you so much for coming by to join us this week. This has been terrifying / educational, as all of our guests tend to be on Bombshell.
And still such a treat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Delightful. We hope to have you back sometime soon.
Thanks. I look forward to it.
All right, moving on to keeping up foreign relations. We're going to start on a bit of a somber note. As probably many of our listeners know, over the weekend there was a pretty serious accident in the Pacific. A destroyer from the 7th Fleet, the Fitzgerald, had a collision with a container ship, and there were a number of casualties. Ultimately, there were 7 missing sailors who ultimately were confirmed dead, and is one of these things that's kind of a reminder of the really stark and sober realities of military service, but also some of the incredible efforts that apparently went on to save the ship.
Yeah, efforts by the sailors, also efforts by allies. It's a testament to how much having good allies really matters. The Japanese were out sort of hand in hand with the U.S. for the search and rescue operation there. And, you know, there was a lot of
wow.
Whew. Don't tell my husband I did that.
Okay.
A lot of efforts went into saving the ship and getting it to port and also minimizing loss of life. So sailors train for fire and flood. Those are the dangers at sea, as dangerous as enemies. And we'll learn more as the after action happens, where they will do a detailed TikTok of what went on and how it happened and how the collision happened and what the responses were. But for now, we know that the standard operating procedures of sort of closing off the flooded units happened. All of the sailors have been identified and next of kin notifications have happened. And it's a reminder of the real dangers of going underway, even, you know, when there are no enemies attacking.
This is actually, to me, one of the most impressive things about the U.S. military, to have, well, in this case, you know, hundreds of sailors on a ship that are trained in the operation of, like, basically a enormous apparatus equivalent to a giant city or factory or whatever level of ship that you have, to be able to be woken up at 2:30 in the morning to have, you know, to a collision alarm and flooding in your ship and tremendous risk and probably a lot of fear going on in the dark, like, what on earth is going on here? And to be able to react so quickly that what could have been hundreds of sailors lost was only was only 7 in this case. So a testament to them that they were able to do all of that, and to our allies as well for coming to the rescue that late at night.
I think the point that it brings out to me, and I'm a little bit less on the process as my Valentine side of things than my podmates over here. But, you know, somebody had to wake up on Saturday morning and then again on Sunday probably and notify those next of kin. They had to call fathers on Father's Day or call spouses and tell them that their husbands or their sons weren't coming home. And in order to do that, that is part of why process matters, is that you went through all of the right decision-making elements, you evaluated all of the risks, and you decided that this was still a worthy effort and endeavor for America's fighting men and women. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that probably in White House Mayhem, but for me, it is always the thing that gives me pause on the things that seem super wonky and super in the weeds and just like a bunch of D.C., bullshit, honestly, I think actually make a real difference when you have to do some of the hardest things that the commanders and commander-in-chief have to do. So
yeah, process is my Valentine because it is there are lives in the balance on a day-to-day basis.
We're going to move on back into the more traditional policy pieces of this. One of the things that was announced last week was a revised Cuba policy. Lauren, you did a little bit of work on that, I think, at one point, or at least observed the revisions to the Obama-era policy toward Cuba. What happened last week?
So President Trump had made a late campaign promise to basically 100% reverse the President Obama's Cuba policy, which did a number of things in late 2014 to 2015 and 2016, ultimately establishing diplomatic relations, doing some elements that would allow direct travel by Americans there, allowing some more financial transactions. You couldn't completely get rid of the embargo without having Congress be involved, but there were a number of steps basically to rationalize and regularize relations between the United States and Cuba. President Trump had said that he would reverse those and partially as a campaign gambit, but ultimately decided to only do some of them. And in his mind, it was... The rationale was basically that, you know, the Cuban government is harming human rights, that it is harming the Cuban people, and therefore we're going to stop dealing with the Cuban government or benefiting them overall.
That's just obviously not the standard that's being applied globally.
It's a little awkward to go from a sword dance with the Saudis to saying that the Cuban government is, harming human rights and hurting their people, and therefore we're going to cut off any sort of economic involvement with them. It's also a bit hypocritical in terms of what was actually done. We're still going to have direct flights to Cuba. Cruises are still going to be able to go to Cuba. Americans are still going to be able to travel, though they were basically given a lot of instructions of you're going to have to keep up with all of your financial transactions with the Cuban government, which was probably meant to intimidate people from not actually going. In short, none of the policy changes that the Trump administration has made are actually going to help Cubans in any kind of useful way, and seem to harken back to the embargo logic, was we are going to cut off relations and economic benefit in order to somehow make things better for Cubans on a day-to-day basis.
It's also not clear that even if you took their arguments at face value, that the goals for either human rights or economic liberalization are sort of benefited from some of these harsher policies. And generally, over time, the U.S. foreign policy on integrating economic activity as a sort of mechanism by which we force other countries to move towards liberalization, both on their political rights and on their economic activities, has been one we've adopted with lots of places, most notably China. So it stands in real stark contrast to have this Cuba policy, especially when it's a real half measure in this context.
Well, I think that's partially because, the Cuban embargo has been an outlier in American policy for several decades at this point. With the exception of North Korea, I don't think there's too many folks that we've completely isolated in the same way. In general, we have leaned toward economic liberalization and trade as a tool of opening, and that, has unified. I mean, certainly there have been both Republican and Democratic presidents who have bought into that particular paradigm. I guess Iran is probably another place where we've had some really strict sanctions and isolation. That's kind of a mutual arrangement at one point. But I think that's I don't know. I mean, you could certainly make an argument about domestic politics with regard to Florida votes and a bunch of other things in terms of Trump's decision making on Cuba. But it doesn't seem like it's going to have a great deal of other broader foreign policy implications, at least not in the very near term.
A quick aside on the negotiation process. Back when I was in government, I would occasionally, when I worked for the National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, receive emails from somebody saying, I'm going to send you a memo. I need you to print it. Don't read it, hand it over and get it signed and make sure it gets to the president. And that's pretty rare that sort of thing happens in my life. Like, typically I would be able to be read into any number of things that were coming through my office. The Cuba policy was one of those rare things that they said, we are completing this negotiation in as much quiet as we possibly can to make sure that it succeeds. And it's, to me, to this day, astonishing that the individuals, Ben Rhodes and a few others involved, actually made this happen in a way that was a tremendous benefit to the United States as well as to the Cuban people. And it's a real, it's with real sadness that I look on this right now, thinking that all of that work was ultimately held back by a campaign promise.
It actually raises kind of an interesting question, though, about just how much foreign policy you can conduct in the very open. And we'll talk about this when we get to the next segment. We talk a little bit more about Syria and Afghanistan. But there's a very interesting set of challenges and a very delicate balance to strike, I think, with regard to how much you're going to conduct negotiations completely transparently and in the wide open versus how much you're going to actually hold things, you know, quite in abeyance and do very delicate, very sensitive negotiations behind closed doors in a way that I think offends certain democratic sensibilities but does have a certain amount of effectiveness as well. And that's a every president, every State Department sort of tries to strike that balance, and you know we'll see how this administration continues to do that going forward. Next up, we want to talk about the United Kingdom, which has had a really terrible couple of weeks, to be honest. We talked about the elections last time. We have the results of those elections, right, Radha?
Yep. So the Tories won, but in the sense that they were the party that got the most votes, but they did not get a majority vote. As a reminder, that's the Conservative Party there.
And we're not going to get into exactly how we do Westminster first past the poll
right.
coalition building around here. But
can you just explain Lord Buckethead to me really quickly?
No.
Really?
But the Googles can help.
Okay.
It's not from Monty Python. That's I was surprised to learn that, I have
to say.
All
right, then.
But as part of the goal of getting a coalition government that had enough votes to be the majority, the Tories have joined with the Democratic Unionist Party, which is the Northern Irish party that is pro-remaining in the, quote, union that matters, which is the UK to them.
It's a very conservative part
of
the unionist branch.
Party, right. And is, in fact, the two extreme parties in Northern Ireland were the ones who picked up seats in this election, Sinn Féin being on the other side. They typically boycott Westminster, so their seats won't be filled and they won't take any votes. So this is posed a number of tricky issues. They're pro-Brexit, though they have different objectives. In particular, they want a soft border with the Republic of Ireland, which is tricky because the Republic of Ireland is in the European Union, and they are part of the EU negotiations, but don't necessarily have their own border control or labor policy separate from EU policies. It's also tricky because, as part of the Good Friday Agreements, the UK government is not
which
supposed to be
taking... ended the conflict with the IRA in Northern
correct.
Ireland.
Yeah. Right. They are not supposed to be taking sides here, and this is a very clear taking the side of
the Westminster government.
That's right.
The central government in London shouldn't be taking sides amongst Northern Irish parties.
And this makes it appear that they're taking sides, which calls into a lot of questions, especially with the tensions regarding reinstituting a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which since everyone's entry into the EU has been a much less of a significant issue. So that's separate from all of the social and economic policy issues that need to be coming down the pipeline in the future that a lot of the Brexit issues related to. And so now we're entering the first phases of Brexit negotiations.
And it's a hot mess.
It's a mess. We're not totally sure what's going to happen. Obviously, Theresa May called the snap elections with the goal of improving her negotiating position. It's clear that it changed her negotiating position. It's not clear that it improved it, per se.
Right.
And so now we're kind of standing by to see where they go with those negotiations and what happens now as they've opened up the discussions on the trade, the labor market, free movement, and immigration policies, all of which are deeply relevant for Europe and the UK, but also things that very much parallel debates happening here in the U.S.
And then meanwhile, there have been multiple terror attacks, an absolutely catastrophic fire, and just my very outside
horrific.
Read of the politics of this is that it's actually not the terror attacks or even the election results that are going to do Theresa May in. It's going to be the policies.
The response
and
to the fire.
Response to the fire. The Queen was out shaking hands. The Queen has some experience walking around rubble in London, although it's been some time. And
it was pretty emotional for her. I mean, she's a tough lady.
When the Queen is out emoting you in the public, you're probably not on your best footing. But, you know, all that said, it sort of leaves, I mean, this is still a special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom is really still a thing. It's our most important ally, especially as we've had rocky relations with the rest of NATO, obviously, following the trip to Europe earlier this year. And the, I mean, British politics is a, I mean, complete dumpster fire at the moment. It's unclear if they're going to have to call another round of elections. This seems like they're nowhere right. on Brexit. They don't even have a lead negotiator because they lowballed the salary. And so
process matters.
It's, you know, one
and
of these
it's not clear the coalition is going to hold. And if
absolutely.
It falls, then they have to hold another election to decide who the party in control is. Which
you know, and meanwhile, the Labour Party's led by Jeremy Corbyn.
Exactly the most dynamic and fabulous leader on the face of the earth. Sorry, Corbynites.
It's a bit of a throwback, to be sure. So just from a sort of, you know, U.S. allied perspective, this is not where you want to see your major European ally working through a really intense set of domestic crises. To say nothing of the homeland security challenges that the Brits are facing as well. So
I think that's a good segue into White House mayhem, because the Brits would be a partner in basically all of the issues that we were going to talk about in this section. If they are not a stable and reliable partner at a time when we don't exactly have a stable and reliable government, it doesn't really give me the warmest fuzzies. So I'm going to have a bit more PIMS as we talk about Afghanistan. And there have been a series of leaks and occasional press conferences, as well as hearings of the past couple of weeks regarding what is our new strategy in Afghanistan, with the bottom line being we don't yet have one.
Air quotes around strategy, guys.
Quotes, because we don't yet have one. It's being written, and it's being written by whom?
Well, we at this point, I think what we know kind of for sure is that troop levels have been delegated down to the Pentagon. So that is not going to be a White House decision, which is quite a change of gears from folks who felt that they had been ruthlessly micromanaged by Lauren, basically.
Pretty much.
To get these numbers to a particular hold in the Obama administration that is now being fully devolved to the Pentagon. What's less clear is whether any of the other elements of the strategy are being devolved from the White House. So it's the Pentagon, to its credit, is very much saying, of course, USAID will be at the table. Of course, there'll be an interagency process. But if the Pentagon's setting troop levels, I mean, that seems like, I mean, they're always kind of first among equals in terms of resources and decision-making on that front. So
there's a lot of cart and horse problems that we have right now in terms of there's continued rumor over the last at least 2 months, if not longer, that an additional 3,000 to 5,000 troops would be going to Afghanistan, which I'll be honest with you, does not strike me as a massive strategy change and more just sort of like a bolstering of the current strategy that we have right now, which is fine. Like I actually wouldn't argue against any addition of troops in that number right now, because it doesn't seem to be changing a lot. But at the same time, what exactly are they doing there? Or how does this relate to the strategy change? And as Aaron said, how does this relate to any additional measures that we're going to have on the diplomatic and economic front?
And I want to push back a little, because I actually do object to the increase in troop levels. It's not clear to me that those increased risks that those troops face being deployed out in a relatively still hostile environment without the sort of force protection and force structure they need meets with the requirements of putting sort of American life and limb at risk. It's not clear to me what the strategic objectives are. And frankly, if we couldn't do it in 2010 with many, many more troops, it's not clear to me what an extra 4,000 to 5,000 guys are going to do other than, you know, and gals, other than be put at risk for injury and death.
So and we've had in the last 2 weeks, two new, what we call green on blue attacks, but attacks by Afghan service members against their American counterparts. Other Afghans have been injured in those attacks too, but we had several folks injured, Americans injured over the weekend, and three Americans killed a couple of weeks ago. And so this is, it's a hard thing, I think, to further bolster that advisory mission without whether it's appropriate force protection but or strategy, but just the basic narrative of it, I think, becomes pretty difficult to sell domestically, but also to motivate folks around in the Army and the Marine Corps who have primarily been staffing those positions.
And I mean, based on where we are right now, it's not clear that any of the lines of operation that we've been executing in Afghanistan over the past decade and a half have been hugely impactful, either in improving security or stabilization or really well-being and outcomes in Afghanistan. And given that, in a world in which we already have constrained budgets at state and aid, and we already have a lot of complicated strategies devolving in places in the world, including in the Middle East, it's just not clear to me that the prioritization and the increased troop levels to Afghanistan are the right decision. But at the very least, to return to Lauren's point, I would like there to be a decision with strategy and justification. And I think here, you know, I'll say this again when we talk about Syria, here, I don't fully agree with the policy, but I really strongly am concerned about the lack of desire to justify the policy on any sort of grounds that people can discuss and debate fruitfully.
And all of our concern is being echoed on the Hill, where Senator McCain this week showed a lot of frustration to Secretary Mattis about, you know, we are not going to continue to authorize or fund this mission in the absence of a strategy. And when you have Senator McCain saying, I don't really want to do this anymore in Afghanistan, this is when the Department of Defense, the National Security Council, sort of lift their heads up and say, I think we have a problem. I was really struck by when Secretary Mattis was saying in his hearing recently that, you know, we're at a stalemate, we're not winning anymore. And the remembrance of it being General Mattis in 2011 or so, when we had 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, to have similar things being said at that point in time. We have around 10,000, am I right about that,
right?
Troops right now. And this seems like a lot of deja vu, but with very different circumstances, but not a lot of big impact on the ground.
There's an article in the New York Times this week on some infighting in Helmand. It's a faction of the Taliban that has split off. They were upset with the way that Mullah Omar's death was essentially handled several years ago. And the government in Kabul has been backing one of these Taliban factions. And so the conflict analyst in me, of course, finds this totally fascinating. Afghanistan basically never disappoints with regard to complex conflict dynamics. The battle space is certainly more difficult now than when Radar or I were there in 2010. There are ISIS factions and others as well in play. But it reminds me of kind of what I took to be the central lesson of Anand Gopal's book, which was No Good Men Amongst the Living, which was that we've never understood what's going on in Afghanistan. And so if the idea is that at the broadest level, we want to apply military force to shape a political outcome, I just feel like we've always been quite naive on what those political outcomes can be and how force and military victories such as they are impact that.
Yeah, and by we, I think the U.S. and then before that, the U.K. and in between those two, the Russians. So yeah. I think this is the collective we. It is, you know, a complicated mess.
Graveyard owners. Speaking of no strategies, where else in the world do we have no strategy and yet a slightly escalating and concerning situation?
Syria.
Good guess.
I don't know. We get to shoot stuff now.
That's true.
Right? Although, to be honest, there are a few places we could have put on that list,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Yemen and North Korea come to mind as well, but
we'll save those for another week.
But we didn't shoot down any North Korean planes this week, so we have a little bit less to talk about there.
Yet. The week is early. So what happened in Syria this week?
A number of things, but I think first among them, we've had sort of this, if not quite tit-for-tat escalation, certainly a testing of boundaries or of red lines between the Iranian militias that Mara mentioned and U.S. forces, both in the south at Al-Tanf, and we've talked about that before, but also the U.S.-supported forces outside Raqqa. And so we're kind of all waiting for the Raqqa operation to finally launch off. And there was Syrian airplanes attacked those forces, and the U.S. essentially came to the defense of its supported ground troops. There are some U.S. advisors on the ground, but it's predominantly non-U.S. forces who were there that resulted in an F-18 shooting down a Syrian airplane, one of the first shoot downs in several decades. I saw conflicting reports whether the last one was in 1999 or whether it was actually in the Gulf War, but it's been a while.
It's been a long
since
time.
We've had an air-to-air takedown. And in addition to that, there were also some Iranian missiles that showed up in theater, fired from Iran. So it is...
And it sounds like the Russians are not... overly pleased by this turn of events.
So all three of these and the many things that preceded them were all the things that came up in the Situation Room from 2012 and going forward about here's why we need to be cautious about getting involved in Syria, because these are all things that could easily lead us into undesired conflicts with a lot of powers that frankly we would rather not be in conflict with. And there's been some responses in social media and elsewhere that like, oh, look, guys, it wasn't nearly as bad as what you thought it was going to be. Everyone relax. I don't think we're quite at that point yet, though. So I'm curious if you guys feel like we are.
Well, I just to sort of follow that thread down, I think that's right. We're not quite there yet. And, you know, Melissa Dalton, when she was on the program here, we talked about it then. And I think it's worth just reiterating that for us, this ISIS is bad and instability in Syria is bad, but they are not fundamentally existential threats to the United States. For Iran, for Assad, this is literally an existential threat, right?
Right.
It's a war to steal. For Iran, this is their last shot at sort of Shia control, or what they perceive as a major shot at Shia control, Shia influence in the region, and their backed regime. And for the Russians, they have a really big state. And while it might not be existential for the Russians, it certainly, they have a much bigger sort of foot in this fight than we do. And given those three actors are ones we, at least two of the three, don't really want to be in direct conflict with, it's a little, I'm not per se opposed to shooting down planes or shooting cruise missiles at things. But I would like to think that if
that
we're doing
about his grave,
I am not per se opposed.
If we're doing it, I just feel like we want to have thought through what are the escalation risks here, and are we willing to sort of play this game of chicken with the Russians and the Iranians? And I'm just not sure we are. I don't think we have the skin in this game that they do. And I worry that that means at the end of the day, it's a conflict that we don't, doesn't meet our strategic interest to escalate towards.
So in closing out this White House mayhem discussion, that all links back to a real concern that I have that the State Department is this huge, weak, floating entity in the interagency right now. It became clear about a week ago that Secretary Tillerson had interviewed no one for any of his assistant secretary roles at the State Department. And if you're not familiar with how that bureaucracy works, those are the true workhorses of the State Department.
As we discussed in the last episode.
They're the ones who are on the phone the most. They're on the road the most. They're dealing with foreign counterparts, negotiating, hearing their concerns, and dealing with crises on a day-to-day basis. And they're really your first line of defense if something has gone wrong in the world. They're the ones who are the most responsive and the ones who will call you up at midnight to say, we've got a problem, boss. So Tillerson had a budget hearing last week where it was clear that he is not necessarily somebody who's really valuing the human capital that comes out of his department.
Senator Corker called him on the carpet, right? I mean, the clip that I heard was Corker basically said, my staff and I started going through your budget proposal that lasted about 5 minutes before I realized that it was absurd. This won't be the budget. I have nothing further to ask you about it.
To which I say, God bless you, Senator Corker.
Which might be the last time we hear that, but I mean,
I might again.
But it just seems clear that he is willing to certainly gut the personnel. There was a report this week, right, Radha, about the
Stopping
Fellows Program.
The Fellows Program, right, which is a program that proactively recruits women and minorities into the State Department for later assignment into Foreign Service and other roles. And those guys are all on hold now, which is just it's going to be hard to recover from that in 5 years from now.
And there's been restrictions on spousal hires, which are a huge part of the kind of Foreign Service summer
culture.
The culture and the process when folks get new assignments, often spouses are working in critical jobs in embassies, but they have to be approved and authorized for that. So for a place that's already been, at least in our general opinion, chronically underfunded and understaffed for probably most of our lifetimes. Thank you, Jesse Helms. We have now kind of added insult to injury on current policy shifts and then anticipated budget cuts, all of which means that, you know, the delegation to the Pentagon, right, is kind of, what's the best word for it? I mean, there's just no one home. There's no one to go to the deputies' meetings. There's no one to go to, you know, the kind of working group interagency. I mean, there's actings. There are folks who are quite capable, you know. But just as with this, you know, collision with the Fitzgerald, there's no Secretary of the Navy and there's no fully appointed ambassador to Japan. There's no one really running the diplomatic side of these processes, fully empowered by the White House, fully empowered by the president and the secretary to speak with that authority.
And there's no one to throw a flag at any instance. And this is a point that Radha has brought up a few times before, where sometimes our allies, the U.S. military, there are actors out there that we want them to come forward with the most extreme version, the most out there version of their proposals, because that's their job. And there are other elements in government that act as a check upon that to say, like, actually, you should have this kind of consideration, or actually, we should talk to these people ahead of time. And that's anticipated and expected in the way our process works, and that's not there right now. So we're seeing the most extreme versions of military strategy, the most extreme versions of alliance management, and I don't think anyone's really happy right now.
Yeah, and I was going to add that, not to bring this back around to CivMil, which obviously we talk about a lot, but
no,
why not?
But just as a broader point, we also don't have former State Department diplomatic style folks in senior decision-making positions, right? So a lot of the national security decisions are being made by explicitly Department of Defense uniformed former uniformed officers or actual uniformed officers serving in civilian positions in the case of General McMaster, right? So we're really getting, not that it's the wrong viewpoint, but it is a particular viewpoint on national security and defense policy, and we're kind of missing out on the diplomatic and sort of soft power side of things, and absent having positions filled there, I don't see how we're going to really recover that.
So on that happy note, pop culture.
Pop culture. Let's talk about pop culture. One thing I learned last week is that Tom Cotton and Jeff Sessions read spy novels.
Really?
Yes. And that they, but they haven't read Red Sparrow. And the reason I know that is because they were apparently quite ignorant of the way that a sitting U.S. senator was trying to be subverted by the Russians at the Tabard Inn. So they should add to their list. And as we've, of course, told all of our listeners previously, Red Sparrow is the best spy novel of the last 25 years. But that was an amusing little tete-a-tete in the Sessions testimony. I've also been watching American Gods. Do you guys know this book / TV series?
So I've read the book, but I haven't seen the series.
I didn't love the book. I didn't love the first part of the series. The series is, in fact, totally gorgeous, mostly because it has Gillian Anderson playing David Bowie, among other characters.
That's
and that's kind of worth, worth the price of admission. But, you know, that's been most of my pop culture for the last couple of weeks.
My pop culture for the last couple of weeks has been retreating back to my happy place and watching Band of Brothers.
That's a weird-ass happy place.
I know. God, I love it so much. And like my best reflection coming out of that is that Lewis Nixon is never really explained. Like a lot of things are not really explained, but he just comes across is this manic pixie dream S2 that sort of pops up and has information and
has, Who doesn't want a manic pixie dream S2?
I know. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Drinks a lot of whiskey. I don't know. He's amazing. In my online Twitter poll, he was everybody's favorite character. Duh.
So, you know, the most depressing part of my week is the day and a half I spend prepping for this podcast, in which all of the stuff I've been like, yeah, that's bad. I'll just worry about that later. I have to reread and remember and come up with things to say about. And so as a solution to that, I like to save up exciting tidbits of news that I can read while prepping. And my most recent one was that Germany apparently will be destroying 39 tons of fidget spinners. That's right, fidget spinners. These are kids' toys that may or may not pose a choking or other injury hazard to children and thus must be destroyed.
Must just be
removed from the market. They must be destroyed. And, you know, they were right to point out that while they look fun, there's no evidence to say that they're beneficial. And how can you argue with that kind of evidence-based logic?
Case studies.
No.
Yes, actually you can.
I don't think so. Rada, you were also very excited to learn that there were, as part of the blockade against Qatar, there were cows being airlifted?
That's right. In fact, I didn't get a chance to ask Mara, because she's both from Wisconsin and a Middle East expert, what's the deal with the cows? Why are we airlifting cows? I mean, I haven't read a lot about the Berlin airlift, but it seems to me that Berlin airlift this is not.
I don't know. Well, on that happy note, as a reminder to folks, all of our listeners, so we got this regular episode coming out. We're going to do a co-podcast with War on the Rocks, Ryan Evans, later this week. And then next week, we're going to be recording live from the CNAS annual conference. So please tune into us at all those points, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks.